tears that you have cried. And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul with your host, Lori Houston. And this is the last show of the season. I'm very excited tonight because tonight I got to read a mystery book, which is, it's called The Gnostic Mystery. And it is by the author Randy Davila. And I was very intrigued by the entire story. The story really is an exciting read. It had comparisons to The Da Vinci Code with the detective work and Celestine Prophecies for the mystical illumination. So welcome, Randy.
Thank you, Lori. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I want to talk about, you know, how did you get where you are now? Because obviously you must, this book is full of religion and it's full of spiritual context. It's, you know, there's a lot of depth to this book. And so I'm assuming that part of your journey has been maybe a strict religious upbringing, I'm not sure, but certainly an interest in religion as well as, you know, spirituality.
Yes, that's correct. I think on all counts, except maybe the strict religious upbringing, I think I was probably in a fairly moderate household, although I did grow up and attend Catholic school and had a traditional Catholic education to that extent. However, I didn't view it at the time and don't necessarily now view that as a bad thing or a detriment. You know? I've always been interested in religion, but as I grew older, that interest deepened in the more mystical side of religion, and that broadened in college in the study of all world religions. And so, as I began to study, you know, more and more about the religions of the East, Hinduism and Buddhism, and of course the West as well, with Judaism and Christianity and Islam, there was a synthesis. To an extent, and what I mean by that is I began to see what the religions have in common, as opposed to where they, you know, where they diverge, and that really, I think, the mystics of all the major world religions, to a certain extent, are saying very, very similar things, and the Gnostics are the original Christian mystics. They are, in my opinion, they are the group of Christians who I argue in the book that the original Christians, the original followers of Jesus, were much more Gnostic-like than their counterparts, those who formed the Roman Catholic Church or the Proto-Orthodox or Literalist Church 1,700 years ago. So the Gnostics, but yet have been forgotten by most in most circles. Most people today are more familiar with the term agnostic than they are Gnostic, and agnostic, of course, as we know, is someone who says, "I do not know if there is a God or not." Well, the term agnostic came later. It is a derivative of the term Gnostic, which means specifically, "I do know." And they meant that I do know that there is a God. And they meant that not in a book knowledge or an intellectual sense in which we use the word to know or knowledge today, but in a very mystical sense, in an almost experiential notion that they had communed with the divine, that they had felt the presence of God within themselves.
Mm-hmm. So, before we get into too much of the historical comparison, because that's what we're going to talk a lot about tonight, you know, how much of you and Jack is in Jack Stanton?
Yeah, that's a good question. And getting back to the, so, you know, for me, as a student of world religion, you know, and seeing and noticing all the comparisons, and really, I didn't begin to study, even though I'd learned a little about the Gnostics in college, I didn't begin to study extensively about them till 5 or 6 years ago, and at that time I was just overwhelmed by all of the information that which you alluded to that we'll talk about shortly, and it really had a profound impact on me, and I felt that that this was knowledge that was certainly available in any academic institution in the United States and in most of those circles. However, as far as the mainstream public goes, 90% of you know, quote-unquote Christians today or people who attend traditional church had never heard of the Gnostics and didn't realize the impact that they have on Christianity. Now, that information is available in a wide variety of nonfiction and historical texts. However, there are no fiction stories that I know of that communicate the Gnostic ideals. And so that's why, in a sense, why this book came out of me the way in which it did. And Jack, there is a lot of parallels between myself and Jack, the main character, because here I lived for 30 years without knowing the vast majority of information that's in that book, and yet I had been to one of the best colleges in the country and studied a little bit about the Gnostics and have been raised Catholic. And as I talked to more people, I discovered the same thing. And so the hope with the book is to reach readers that would not ordinarily pick up a nonfiction text on Gnosticism or religious history.
Right. And so it definitely is woven in throughout the story, and there's lots of ways that this is done. And I really enjoyed the story. So it was a quick read. I read it very quickly, and I really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed, you know, a lot of the metaphysical interpretations that you created. And of course, we need to have something that people are going to pick this book up for. So we're not going to talk about that at all. But, you know, it is woven throughout the book, and there's a lot of, you know, unique interpretations on that. And I think, you know, it's really well worth people, you know, wanting a read that is, you know, fun and interesting, although there's some really deep messages in there. And, you know, certainly one of the other parts of this book is talking about going to the Holy Land and, you know, the suicide bombing that's occurring there, and, you know, how holy is this? And, you know, it's a sad state of affairs that has also been tied into this story, which is, you know, a really great read.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the book is meant to speak on three different levels. There's the historical aspect. There's the metaphysical interpretations of what the history implies. And then, of course, there's the literary aspect and the story. And quite right, you know, this is a book about our main character, Jack Stanton, who's having a midlife spiritual crisis, so to speak. He's been a very successful businessman, and he travels to the Holy Land in an attempt to rekindle the Christian faith of his childhood. And in doing so, he teams up with his old college buddy and former very, very devout Catholic, Poonji, who's now an ER doctor. And with Jack, Poonji, acquire an ancient scroll written by the Gnostic Christians, and they turn to our resident expert, Professor Chloe Eisenberg, who is steeped in the history of Gnosticism and religion and philosophy. And they begin a journey to explicate the meaning of the Gnostics, and then they travel around the Holy Land visiting the various sites. And along the way, Chloe informs them about an alternative history to Christianity, the one that neither of them learned in parochial school. And that's really, you know, so the novel is didactic in that way, but at the same time, it's an entertaining story that gives you a lot of historical meat along with it.
A lot, which is really unique, I think, and it was what made it very interesting for me. You don't talk a lot about, you talk a lot about the mystery religions and the Gnostics. You don't talk a lot about the Essenes. That's one area that I think, you know, a lot of people have touched on in the past, especially with regards to Jesus's life. You do talk about, you know, a lot that we'll get into about historically about who Jesus was. But I do think, you know, and I think you've kind of left it open for a sequel regarding the Dead Sea Scrolls and maybe talking a little bit more about the Essenes. I'm not sure.
Oh, you're right. You're right on that. Yep. I telegraphed that one pretty strong.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that will be equally as interesting because I think that's a different, I've read a lot about, you know, people that have gone, recalled past lives and different things where Jesus has been involved, and the Essenes definitely seem to be, you know, something. And I don't know that I really recognized before that that was a Jewish religion, but I probably should have. I just hadn't really
thought about it. Well, yeah, the Essenes are certainly play a predominant role in the formation of Christianity and in the book, The Gnostic Mystery, from a historical standpoint. And so we can talk briefly about the Essenes. They were one of the three branches of Judaism that was active, very active, 2,000 years ago, around the time of the formation of the Christian religion. The other two, of course, being the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who you remember from the New Testament. Those are the ones who crucified Jesus. Now, the Essenes are notably absent from any mention in the New Testament at all.
Yeah.
And it's so, and it's almost like a backhanded endorsement in that sense. And so what that combined with the Essenes were had a very important practice. Their most important practice was ritualistic baiting for the forgiveness of sins that looked, of course, much like what we call baptism in Christianity. In addition to that, the terminology of the Dead Sea Scrolls was very, very similar in the terminology of Paul's letters and the other early Christian churches. They had terms like saints and, you know, the Church of the Holy Spirit, and there were various, you know, various other, you know, pointers that indicate that the Essenes were most likely the Jews that converted to Christianity. And the last piece of that puzzle is that the Essenes essentially fall off the map as a group around 70 or 80 A.D., which is the time when Christianity really begins to get going and really get supercharged. So at that point, it's as if there was a gradual shift of these Jews who are now no longer classifying themselves as Essenes, but were now classifying themselves as Christians because they believed that the Messiah had come earlier in the form of Jesus Christ.
Right. Yeah. And you know, from what I've read, and whether that's accurate or not, the Essenes seem to be what you also term a mystery religion, which is that they go through levels and, you know, there are certain mysteries to attain as you go through these different levels. But I don't know.
Well, you know, I would probably be careful in qualifying them specifically as a mystery religion, because I think that when we speak of mystery religions, that's the other side of the Christian coin. On one side of the coin, we have the Essenes, because as I make the argument in the book from a historical standpoint, the birth of the Christian religion is the product of the mother of Essenian Judaism and the father of the Greek and Roman mystery, the father of the Greek and Roman mystery religions. And so, briefly, the mystery religion, which is, to me, some of the most revelatory information in the book, that is how little is known in just everyday society, the dependence that Christianity, or the gratitude that Christianity has to the mystery religions for some of its most important and sacred concepts. The mystery religions were very, very predominant in Greek and Roman religious life, and much like the Gnostics, the mystery religions were very esoteric, very mystical, you know, made bold pronouncements that, of course, another misnomer that, you know, the New Age movement, because I don't think there's anything new about the quote-unquote New Age movement, you know, they said things like, we are all one, that the kingdom of God is inside you, that God is inside in each and every one of us, that there's no difference between man or woman, that there's no difference between, you know, racial or ethnic or class structures, that everyone is equal, that you don't need an intermediary to go to God. You don't need to go through a priest or a bishop, that you can go to God directly. In fact, that God is closer than hands and feet. God is, in fact, inside of you. A piece of God is inside of you. So, and their goal was to experience bliss something akin to the Eastern concept of enlightenment. Their goal was to experience, a realization of God in this life, in this moment, in this now. This was not something that was to be put off to the afterlife. And something else was very, very different about these mystery religions from the other more traditional religions of Greece and Rome, with Zeus and Jupiter and Apollo. Those religions, the older religions of the Greek and Roman empire, were very, very totalitarian in the sense, and that you got the gods were forces and entities to be feared. No one in the ancient world saw Zeus or Jupiter as their friend, so to speak. And in many ways, there, as I make the case in the book, and I think it's pretty clear, the gods of ancient Greece and Rome, the older ones, Zeus, Jupiter, Apollo, their behavior was much like Yahweh or Jehovah of the Old Testament. In that way, they were very similar. You know, they would burn cities to the ground to punish disobedience. They were very ego-driven. Demanded praise, demanded worship, and demanded sacrifice. Well, the mystery religions were, and most people don't realize, they were very, very different in that vein, in that they said, no, God is our friend. You know, the mystery religion God is our friend. It wants a personal relationship. We turn to them in times of trouble and need. They're all loving, very benevolent. Which it's hard to imagine, but like I said, 2,100 years ago and beyond, you made sacrifices to God because you were scared of them. Because if you didn't, you were afraid that you would have a poor harvest, or you would be stricken with illness, or some horrible thing would happen. It was not the idea of there's a God up there who loves me and is helping me, throughout my day that I can turn to. That did not enter Western religious thought predominantly until the mystery religions and, of course, the Christianity, right, which is very similar in that sense. So the Christian religion, in my opinion, is a marriage of the Essenic branch of Judaism and the Greek and Roman mystery religions.
Well, let's talk about the literalists, because that seems to be, a huge area in the book, and it seems to be how we created what we have now, but also a lot of changes sort of occurred around that time. And, most of us have heard of Constantine, that he was, definitely the leader in this area. I don't think a lot of people... I had never heard of Helena, which is, I'm assuming, is his mother.
Right.
Is that his mother?
Correct.
And that she was the one that found all of these holy spots that were holy for other religions. And also, I'd never heard of Bishop Eusebius.
Eusebius, that's correct, yeah.
So, these are interesting characters, because
they're interesting, very, very important characters,
yeah,
in the unfolding of the Christian religion and the turns that it took. So, yes, we've been talking about the Gnostics. Now let's talk about the other Christians, the literalists, so to speak. And this was the group that scholars often refer to as the proto-Orthodox, because they would what they believed would come to be Orthodox teachings. These literalists were the ones that formed and became the Roman Catholics at the Council of Nicaea in 326 A.D. So for the first 300 years... at some point, there was, there was an emergence and a split of two groups. I mean, at some point, you start with your original followers of Jesus, and at some point, things went in two different directions. And and when that happened is a matter of debate. But one thing is clear: by the second and third centuries, there were two very, very distinct groups of Christians. One was Gnostics, and the other were literalists. And they were called literalists because they believed in a very, very literal interpretation of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the Acts of the Apostles. So the four biblical gospels that would later be included, that they would include in the canon of the New Testament that they put together in around 350 A.D., and the Acts of Apostles, which was written by the same person who wrote the Gospel of Luke. Now, they believed that that was the historical events in the life of a man named Jesus of Nazareth, that everything that was written and communicated in those four books was, in fact, the quote-unquote gospel truth, that Jesus was born of a virgin, that he performed miracles, and that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and 3 days later rose dead. Now, that's, of course, the story that we all know so well today, and the reason for that is because the literalist message triumphed and came the Roman Catholic Church, and they put together the Bible shortly after that, and that reigned supreme for the next 1,200, 1,300 years until Martin Luther, and then we have deviations after that. But in the West, that is the story of Christianity. Now, or a simplified version of it. Now, what most people fail to realize in that process is that the three main elements of Jesus' life that are communicated, the virgin birth, the miracles, and the death and resurrections, were all stories, were all that had been in circulation for hundreds of years, and were told about the gods of the mystery religions. Almost all the gods of the mystery religions, Mithras, Perseus, Adonis, Attis, Dionysus, all of these mystery religions gods, mothers were virgins, their father was Zeus or Jupiter himself. They were born in the scenario that you may be familiar with. They were, what I mean by that is, they were often born under the announcement of a magical star that appeared. They were visited by kings. Their birth was witnessed by shepherds. Their mothers were often visited prior to the birth by angels or other gods, and explained to them that I know you're a virgin, but you've been selected for a special mission. You're going to give birth to the Son of God. Now, what we have to remember is that the Gnostics, or that at that time, you wouldn't be taken seriously as a god if you weren't born of a virgin. You know, it'd be like if you and I went and saw an action movie today. We would expect that the character would be, 6 foot tall and very muscular and have a big gun and drive a fast car, and there would be shootouts and chases and damsel in distress, and there would be a whole series of elements that we've come to expect in an action film today. And so if we walked in there and there was a little weak, frail-looking guy like me with glasses and he didn't have a big gun and he was, overweight it just wouldn't be believable. We would say, gee, this film is just unrealistic. And that's, in some ways, that's very analogous to what happened in the ancient world, is that, stories, the argument of the book is that stories like the virgin birth and the others I mentioned were ascribed to the life of Jesus of Nazareth, whomever he may have been, but certainly a great teacher and a wonderful, radical thinker and egalitarian who touched the lives of thousands with his bold pronouncements of "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you," which was just life-changing when followed. So, but the Gnostics ascribed these other events to Jesus' life because that was the norm for gods, for to be recognized as a god at that time.
Yeah. And yet the literalists then believed it had to be true, or they...
Well, yeah, the literalist argument was, and really this, the Justin Martyr wrote what's called the First Apology. He was a literalist church founding father in 150 A.D. He was almost like the first lawyer for the Roman Catholic Church, before they were actually the Roman Catholic Church, so for the literalist church. And he wrote a lengthy letter to the Roman officials and to the Senate demanding that they stop persecuting Christians. And why they were persecuting Christians, there's many, many reasons for that, one of which being that religion and politics were inseparable in ancient Rome. So if you were a member of another religion that refused to acknowledge the Roman religion, that was as much a political statement, much more so than it was a belief in faith. However, moving along, Justin Martyr wrote a letter asking for the Romans to please stop persecuting Christians. And in the letter, he says, you know, when we say that Jesus, you know, our God, was born of a virgin, performed miracles, and crucified and rose again, we say nothing different than you say about a variety of gods that you've worshipped for a long time. Why are you persecuting us? He went on then to argue that of course, he said, now in our case, all of that's true. It really happened. In your case, that's all stories. And he coined what would later become church doctrine. He coined a phrase called diabolical mimicry, in which explained that is that you know, St. Justin the Martyr argued that the devil created these other stories about other gods prior to Jesus' coming, several hundred years, these other comparative stories, so that when Jesus really did come and do all those things, that would man a doubt would be planted in the hearts and minds of man. Now, that's a creative argument.
Very creative.
It's also very, very circular, you know, and it relies on the premise, well, the devil did it. And that may have been a very effective argument 2,000 years ago, but I don't think it's an effective one today.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more likely that the gospel writers, whom had no idea when they wrote the Gospels what would eventually happen, I have no doubt that when they wrote those as epic stories to communicate allegorical or very deep spiritual ideals. They had no idea that 300 years later, a group of men would get together in the church and form a pact at the Council of Nicaea that essentially said that anyone who doesn't believe this, we damn them to hell, and we'll help them get there by burning them at the stake. In the meantime, you know, it's just unfathomable to think that St. Paul, when he wrote the 20% of the New Gospel, of the New Testament, you know, all the many, many letters that he wrote, that he had no idea that that would have happened. In fact, had St. Paul known that his letters were going to be revered and taken so seriously for the next several hundred years, he would have been far more careful about what he wrote. Sure. When you look at these things in a historical perspective, from an academic perspective, things change. And the challenge and one of the questions at the end of the book is if you were presented with you know, one of the four Gospels today, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, and you had no idea, you grew up on, you know, a deserted island, you've never heard of Christianity, you've never heard that story, you know, would you read that book and think, oh, this is historical fact, or this is fiction? This is a beautiful story, a beautiful teaching story that is just got so much wonderful, great ideas. Now, do I think that this really happened exactly this way? Well, probably not. You know, for me, that would be, I think, my honest reaction to that. Now, I tell you, I went for 30 years and believed that things happened.
Yeah.
Most probably just like that.
Yeah.
Because I had no exposure to the ideas, and it was ingrained in me from such a young age that's what happened and just not questioned. There was a part of me that said, man, there's something about this story that's maybe not quite right, but at the same time, there was no alternative offered, you know, so I just said, well, you know, maybe that's the way it happened. But when you start to look at the historical comparisons between other religions, and the most striking of which being that the other mystery religions their gods were savior gods who, even if not through crucifixion, were ultimately sacrificed in some form or another for the sins of mankind, only to rise again a few days later to show their immortality and their ultimate promise of deliverance of life after death, which is a beautiful story with deep, deep spiritual and allegorical meaning, and that's the metaphysical part that I try to attempt to explain in the Gnostic mystery. Is I say, well, if the crucifixion isn't about what I was told, what's it really about? What made the Gnostics about? Why was this story repeated and repeated and repeated in these various different religions? Mm-hmm. And what is so important? What's deep spiritual truth? Are they attempting to communicate to us in stories such as these?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's also the belief, as you talked about the Gospels, that these were actually, you know, four or five of the 12 disciples that actually followed with Jesus.
Yes, I mean, and there's so much in just New Testament scholarship that is really unknown. It's unknown in modern circles, in the vast majority of modern circles today. I just mean the average man or woman on the street who are going to church, you know, every Sunday or you know, Christmas and Easter or what have you, whatever or somewhere in between, and yet do not have a good understanding of what's in the text of their own faith, mm-hmm. in many cases, and why is that? Well, remember, after they put the Bible together in 350 AD, no one was allowed to read the Bible except the priests for the next 1,500 years. You know, in other words, you couldn't read the Bible in the Catholic Church unless you were a priest for 1,500 years later. So we have it's almost genetically ingrained in us that only the leaders of the church actually read the Bible. That they then teach it, that we don't need to read it ourselves, we rely on someone else. Well, that, of course, has its pitfalls, as we see. And again, I'm not trying to be, a critique of religion and mass. I'm just simply saying I think it's very important if I subscribe to a specific faith that I read the text and garner information for myself, that I do that on a firsthand basis. And so as we've done this over the last, you know, couple of hundred years, and really over the last 50 to 100,
mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of things have come out. And the first thing is, and even in the most conservative scholars will agree, even at the most conservative biblical schools in the country, that there was no eyewitnesses. None of the four Gospels were written by eyewitness accounts. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are no reference to apostles or anyone who probably even knew the apostles. Back in the ancient times, it was a noted practice to write something anonymously and ascribe its authorship to someone who was supposed to have been there at the time. That was a way of that was what was accepted. That it would had much better chance of being read at that point if it was accepted in that way. So if you were an unknown figure, no one cared. So you wrote that you implied that you were there. Now what we know now, just based on the timing of when the Gospels were written, that it's simply impossible that they were written by eyewitnesses. Secondly, the order of the Gospels were written in, not the order that they appear in the Bible. Mark was written first, followed by Matthew and Luke, and John was written last. Now, Mark, in fact, is almost the basic Gospel for the next three, but definitely for the next two, Matthew and Luke. In fact, that is referred to as those three Gospels are referred to as the Synoptic Gospels, Mark being the oldest and Matthew and Luke following. And the reason for that is because it's very, very clear that Matthew and Luke copied extensive accounts from Mark and simply improve the grammar and the dialect and change the wording. There's almost, you know, page after page of almost verbatim text that it's no one who studies these can, you know, has come to any other conclusion that except that the authors of Matthew and Luke copied from Mark. Now, in fact, there is a part where, you know, there were still scholars that were arguing, well, we think that Matthew was written by the disciple Matthew. Yet, it is exactly in one area where Matthew is talking with Jesus that the author of Matthew copies from Mark. So why would Matthew copy an account of his own exchange? You know, anyway, I don't want to get too specific in this, and but there are several. There's lots we can learn ourselves about the New Testament gospel simply by reading them. And the other interesting piece in this puzzle is that St. Paul, whose all of his biblical letters, with the exception of Timothy and Titus, which all scholars agree were not written by Paul. They're in fact forgeries, and again assigned to him later. But the others, which are widely accepted as genuinely written by St. Paul, are very interesting. They were all written before any of the biblical Gospels, because Paul was a contemporary of Jesus. He arrived on the scene shortly after the Christian movement really began to take off. Yet, in none of his biblical letters does St. Paul mention any of the major characters of the New Testament Gospels, like Judas Iscariot, Pontius Pilate, Mary, the mother of Jesus. He doesn't mention any of these people. He mentions Peter, James, and John, but he doesn't mention that they were followers of Jesus or that they knew Jesus personally. He lists them as leaders of the Jerusalem Christians. So the point I want to make in that is that the way they organized the New Testament, they placed the Gospels first and Paul's letters immediately after them. It gives the appearance that St. Paul is commenting on the events that we've all agreed upon and read in the New Testament, the first four Gospels. But, of course, he hasn't, because they weren't written yet.
Right.
So he's not commenting on the four Testament Gospels. He's actually talking about Jesus and never mentioning these quote-unquote major characters. Now, that's huge. Why would Paul never mention the virgin birth? Why would Paul never, the biggest evangelist of all time, converted more people to Christianity than anyone, why would he never mention the miracle stories? Well, I think, and I think many scholars feel this way too, that the reason Paul never mentions those stories is because he didn't believe them. He knew that they were stories that were ascribed to mystery religion gods. They simply were not true. And, you know, so there's lots of things we can gather to answer your question just from studying the New Testament from an academic sense and reading it ourselves.
It's really amazing because, you know, I think like most people, you know, we just grow up in the religion. We listen to certain things. We take from it what we want from it. And I don't think most of us do read it. So I think you're, you know, because I would never have known any of this.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And of course, Christianity is such a beautiful religion. I mean, the ideas, like I said, of do unto others and turn the other cheek. And there's just the way in which Jesus lived and his life and the messages of love and forgiveness and peace. If we all did that today, this world would look very, very different. We would in fact live, in my opinion, in a paradise, you know, in heaven on earth. We would return to the Garden of Eden if we could all live that way. And yet, you know, when we get bogged down, and this is really kind of the thrust of the book. I think, you know, I there's so many things about the traditional church that I love, and they do wonderful, many, many wonderful things in helping the poor and the pursuit of the spiritual experience. I mean, I am a fan of traditional church in that way. However, where I take issue with is the ideas and the teachings that are of fear and guilt, mm-hmm. which are fairly implicit in the way the gospel story is presented today.
Yeah.
The thrust of the idea in most or in many, many churches today is that God died, you know, for our sins, that God died for your sins. So you can imagine a young child walking into church for the first time, and he walks in and looks up on the wall, and there's a man nailed to a cross. So the child says, "Well, who's that?" And the response is, "Well, that's God's son, and he died for you."
Yeah.
So what's implicit in that is the, oh my gosh, two things. First, oh my gosh, what did I do that was so bad that someone had to die for it? And two, if that's what God did to his son, what is he going to do to me?
Yeah.
You know? So and again, I'm not saying that churches are consciously trying to speak. I fully get and understand the sacrifice and the good meanings behind that story, even as it's presented. However, I think that we have to be very, very careful and very, very cognizant of that implicit guilt and fear that is so prevalent. And the Gnostics, I have no doubt, would say that is where we have gone way off track, we've almost moved in language is limited, but because we can't really move away from God, but we've moved away from our awareness of God, so to speak. We moved away from our realization of who we are when we travel down the road. If spirituality, if fear and guilt are involved in my spirituality, then I have to stop and check myself. I know right away I'm on the wrong track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, I know we've mentioned some of them, but the assimilated traditions. So, you know, we all think, although most of us have heard, that December 25th really isn't the day of his birth.
Right. And that was the day of the winter solstice, or what was the birth of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Right around that time, December 25th was fairly close, you know, somewhere mm-hmm. in the 20s. And so back in ancient Rome, and the god Mithras was the sun god. And it was only natural that you celebrated his birthday on the birth of the new sun, when the sun, you know, the first day that gets longer, where the light sun stays out, you know, a little bit more, the winter solstice.
Mm-hmm.
And so Constantine, who, you know, of course, saw the value. Constantine was the Roman emperor that converted to, for those of your listeners who don't know, converted to the literalist form of Christianity, essentially giving them the backing of the Roman government. And the result was the Roman Catholic Church. So now we had a marriage between the Roman government and the Catholic Church. And it was essentially that became the predominant Christian faith from that point forward. Now Constantine, in an effort to make the religion, the followers of Mithras, make it easy for them, because they were a very, very widespread mystery religion, to make it easy for them to convert to Christianity, he named that Jesus' birth would also be celebrated on December 25th. So the birthday of the sun god, S-U-N, became the birthday of the son of God, S-O-N. Another one that's, one of the most, I think, one of the best comparisons is the god Dionysus. Now, Dionysus was a mystery religion god who became very, very popular for performing one particular feat, and that was changing water into wine. In fact, he became so well known for doing that he was referred to as the god of wine, Dionysus, the god of wine. He would regularly change water into wine, much like Jesus did in his first miracle in the Gospel of John. Now, Dionysus' lover was Demeter, who was the goddess of bread and grain. And in ancient ceremonies, when one wanted to commune with their god, in the rites and passages of mystery religions, you would eat the body of the goddess of grain or bread and drink the blood of the god of wine. So it's not, it's very clear where Christianity, you know, borrowed from when we used the bread and the wine as the symbol of Jesus's, you know, body and blood. And so those similarities that, you know, when if people just stop to think and say, yeah, where did that come from? You know, where, why did they choose bread and wine as a symbol? You know, what was the virgin birth? What was important about that? You know, these mystery religion gods and other traveling holy men often demonstrated their power by healing the sick, you know, making the lame walk and curing the blind. And again, I'm not trying to suggest that, in fact, that those things don't happen. I believe that they can and do happen. However, there were very, very clear parallels, and it was a very, very, you know, normal for someone of who wanted to be recognized as a god that person would have to be able to heal the sick and even raise the dead.
Mm-hmm. And as many stories as you came up with, as many traditions that are out there that have different gods doing different things, I think Jesus is the one that sort of brought all of them together.
Christianity is the one that triumphed.
Yeah.
Christianity is the one that triumphed. And, you know, there were religious wars going on for years, but when Constantine said, oh, I'm going to be a Christian, when the king decides, you know, and for lack of better terms, he was a king, the emperor, when he says, hey, I'm going to be this religion, well, if you're smart, you get on board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and many people got on board, but we have to remember that this was 300 years, you know, after the time of Jesus, and this was 200 years after the Gospels had been written, and 250 years after the letters of Paul had been written. So not unlike every major world religion that I've studied, the religion is founded by a very mystical person, a person that is, when you're in their presence, you just feel differently. There's something about them that is, they are in a full realization of who and what they really are and of their connection with God, and they say things like, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Which, if you can divorce yourself from any evangelical baggage that may be associated with that statement in today's world, 2,000 years ago, that was an incredibly mystical statement. When you heard that, you're like, my gosh, what is this man talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is incredibly mystical. So religions were started by these great mystics. And unfortunately, like I said, in almost every case, within 200 to 300 years, it's been institutionalized and changed into a hierarchy and an institution and power has set in, and then there is you know, assets and need to control, and the ego has turned it into something that looks very, very different than what the original founder preached.
Right. And so Helena, his mother, she really, like, she was supposed to be the psychic or the channeler that was able,
yes,
to pick out these spots?
Yes, you mentioned Helena, and I wanted to talk about that. Yeah, St. Helena, who, in
right,
fact, in my hometown here, there's St. Helena's Church, and most of my several friends who go there, and they have no idea who St. Helena is, or why she was, why, you know. But St. Helena was Constantine's mother. In fact, she became a Christian, by most indications. She became a Christian and brought him into the fold. So undoubtedly, you know, that her, you know, belief in the religion was real. However, from a political aspect, she was also very, very instrumental. She, in 325 AD approximately, travels to Jerusalem and travels to Bethlehem, and in the process finds, quote-unquote, or discovers the location of Jesus' birth, where the Church of Nativity is built today in Bethlehem, and the location of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is built today in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, what was there before were temples to older gods, Venus and Adonis, I believe. And these shrines, these temples, had to be torn down so that the new Christian churches could be built in their place. Now, how she was able to locate these sites, 300 years later, remains a mystery to this day. She claims to have had a dream. There's a variety of different legends as to how, but there's never been any historical or archaeological evidence, any compelling historical or archaeological evidence, that would lead scholars to think that she got those sites correct. It seemed much more like a very, very appointment. You know, Constantine had become a Christian, and now it was time to establish shrines at the most important of Christian sites.
Wow. And even the Vatican is supposed to have been...
Right. And the Vatican itself is built on top of what was formerly a temple of the god Mithras, the god we just discussed a moment ago, who was the sun god and whose birthday was December 25th. And even more interesting, and this is, and I couldn't put it all in the book because it would have been 1,000 pages, but not a quick read, which is what it was designed to be, just an introduction, is that the Mithras was a men's club, unfortunately, as well. And they often wore little red cloaks and wore little red beanies, much like the cardinals that took their place adopted. And they spoke Italian, and their word for their leader was pater papum, but very, very similar linguistically to our term that we call pope. So it's... You know, in history of religions is the history of synthesis, and it's the history of things changing and from one to another, but the old is not ever completely discarded. It's quite interesting because, 2,000 years ago there were millions of people that were just as sure that Mithras or Dionysus or whoever their particular mystery religion god was just as true and right in every way in which many, many Christians today feel about Jesus. And that can be very, very helpful in from a process of learning and practicing and growing spiritually. But it can... And this is the literary function of the book. It can also be very detrimental if we take a position that says, my idea about God is right and yours is wrong. Because as we see in the conflict in the Middle East, ultimately they say, well, now I have to kill you because we disagree. Now, we get that jump is the subject of another book. but at the crux of that, at the core of that, is the ego. You know, it's the idea that I'm right and you're wrong. And if the inability to tolerate another one's beliefs or ideas about God, sadly, has produced tremendous amounts of human suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And I don't think Jesus was for that.
No. No, I don't think so. Yeah, it's really amazing how religions have somehow created that competition and, you know, that somehow their God is better than ours and therefore that's a reason that they can kill for. I mean, it's... And yet it's seems to be the radicals in each of the religions. It's not the message.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not mainstream. There's lots of great things, as I always try and point out. You know, this is not to be seen as an attack on organized religion. That's not the case I'm making.
Yeah.
But we do have to be careful, you know, of within our own self, you know, where, you know, if we're not careful, where we can go, because where we've been as far as the religious wars and the religious intolerance.
Mm-hmm. So there's one other character that I'd like to discuss, which you didn't get into too much, and I have a feeling it might be more in the next book, but that would be the teacher of righteousness.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, the teacher of righteousness, according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, was the founder of the Essene branch of Judaism. And the teacher of righteousness was lived in, we think, about approximately 150 BC. So about 150 years before what is generally understood to be the time of Jesus, the time. And my own personal opinion, and of course I don't, you know, I don't claim how anyone can argue this conclusively, but mm-hmm. I feel, based on looking at the evidence, that we have misplaced, and I make this case, of course, much more detailed in the book, that
yeah.
we have misplaced Jesus in the historical context, that Jesus was not crucified by mm-hmm. Pontius Pilate. If he was, St. Paul certainly would have mentioned that, because he lived under the reign of Pontius Pilate, was very, very familiar with Pontius Pilate. That Mark, the author of the Gospel of Mark, chose to place Jesus' crucifixion at the hands of Pilate, because Pilate was one of the most legendary and brutal killers of Jews in that time period. You know, not on the global scale, but like Hitler, but he was the Hitler of the Holy Land, so to speak. In fact, Pilate was ultimately recalled to Rome because the Romans felt he was being too harsh. Here are people who threw their prisoners to the lions to watch and them be devoured for entertainment, and they felt that Pilate was just too tough, you know, when they had to recall him. So anyway, I do not think that Jesus was crucified under Pilate. Now, the teacher of righteousness obviously had a very, very huge impact on the Essenes. And now that he was also, according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, killed by some jealous Pharisaic or Sadducee priest, and, much like Jesus was. He was killed for his revolutionary ideas and for the fact that he led this community, a new community of believers out in the desert. And so this was and started the ritualistic practice of bathing. So if you look at the character of the teacher of righteousness, there are very, very strong parallels to that person and Jesus other than the time frame. Now, so therefore, if we get rid of Pilate, if there's no evidence other than the four New Testament Gospels that Jesus was actually crucified by Pilate under Pilate's reign, then there's no reason to keep Jesus in that time period, and he can be moved back 150 years. And I think that is a much more ample time, because we are clear that Paul arrived on the scene in around 30 AD and that he had his vision of Jesus, that Jesus visited him in a dream. But at that time, there were already Christian communities in Thessalonica and Galatica and Rome and places that he wrote his letters to.
Wow.
And I think that it's much more likely that those communities had been around for quite some time, that they had not, they did not just spring up overnight. And that's what I gather from reading Paul's letters, that these communities had been in place for a while. And interestingly enough, every letter that, you know, Paul addresses letters to these regions also had Essene communities. So I think over, 150 to 200 years, you had a process of seeing Jews being more and more recognized as Christians. And finally, with the Jewish revolt in 68 AD, when Rome and the emperor himself had to come down to Jerusalem and 100,000 Jews died, it was no longer a good idea to be recognized as a Jew anymore, because Christians were certainly in disfavor later, but Jews were always in disfavor in the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And so the Christians, the Essenes, now distanced themselves, were not Jews, were Christians. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was as much as a political survival tool as it was, initially anyway, as it was the founding of a new religion.
Right. Well, Randy, I think, you know, this is a great book. Anybody that's looking for, you know, a fun book to read in the summer, even though it has a lot of, deeper messages and definitely deeper understandings. But, you know, if you're looking for something that's a unique and interesting read, I think this is one book that you want to pick up, and it's called The Gnostic Mystery. And, you know, I really enjoyed it. So, and I really look forward to your next one, and I hope you'll come back and share it with us.
Certainly will, Lori. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to be here, and thank you for all your support of Hampton Roads authors who are, of course, this book is distributed by Hampton Roads Publishing, and we really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. All right. So take care.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.